Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Paul. It's nice to be back here in studio with you again. And I'd like to welcome all our listeners to the next chapter with Charlie. I am Charlie Hedges, and this is the show where we discuss ideas for you and your next chapter. Now, today is part two of a series that I began last week on the disturbing issue of erasing family. Last week, we interviewed a mom who has experienced this form of spousal abuse that has a devastating results on the children involved. Check this out. An amazing 22 million parents in the United States alone find themselves in the middle of this tragic situation, technically known as parental alienation, and we will discuss that in detail in the interview. My guest today is Ginger Gentile, who is an expert in this field. Ginger is an award-winning filmmaker who grew up in New York and graduated from Columbia University. She's the co-director of this new documentary on the subject titled Erasing Family, which depicts stories of a disturbing number of children and parents that are erased from their families due to divorce and to the current, often ineffective, child custody laws. As I mentioned last week, these may be two of the most important shows we've done on the next chapter with Charlie. So let's welcome Ginger to the show, discover what Erasing Family is all about, and how we might help. Ginger, welcome to the next chapter with Charlie.
Hi, Charlie. It's great to be here on the next chapter.
It's great to have you with us. And so I'll tell you what, I'm going to put you on the spot right away. I don't have these soft introductions. You know, let's just get right to it. And so last week, for the people that listen, we kind of gave an introduction to Erasing Family, but there will be a lot of people listening that haven't heard our last show last week. So perhaps you could begin by giving us sort of a brief overview of the context of Erasing Family and what it's all about.
Sure. Erasing Family is the third documentary feature that I am directing, and it's actually a follow-up to a film that came out in 2014 called Erasing Dad, which I made in Argentina, which is a country that I lived in for 13 years. And when I was there, I met a man, and one of the first things he told me was that he couldn't see his daughter, and he was very depressed. And I come from a family of lawyers. I'm not a lawyer. So I said, okay, I'll look at your case for you, because sometimes it's good to have a fresh set of eyes looking at legal documents.
Sure.
And what I found, which was very odd, was that the judge kept on saying that he had the right to see his daughter, but he was unable to see his daughter because the mother never brought the daughter to see him at visits, in court-appointed therapy. Basically, the mother just never showed up with the daughter. And this went on for years, and he thought he was one of the few people going through this. He met a few other people at the courthouse, and I decided to start making a documentary film about this. And when I first started working on this around 2011, nobody wanted to talk to me, professionals, parents going through this, because there was so much shame, because it's so hard when someone asks you, oh, how's your kid doing? You can either lie and say, oh, they're doing great, or to say, I have no idea where my kid is.
And how do they say that?
And most parents how can you say that to an acquaintance? I don't know where my kid is. I don't know how they're doing. I haven't heard from them in 4 years.
And it makes them sound bad automatically. It makes them sound at fault by even saying that, making that statement.
Right. And then people often say, especially in Argentina, oh, if you can't see your kid, you must have raped your kid. You must have beat your wife. Just people jump to these conclusions. And through my investigation with the film, what I found is that these families are victims of institutional violence, in that the court system has utterly failed to protect the parent-child bond. And not only the parent-child bond, but that bond with grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, and in many cases, siblings, because blended families are very common. So when a child loses contact with a parent, it's very common for them to lose contact with their half-siblings. And in the film in Argentina, which is very interesting, we got professionals on camera to admit on how they actively work to erase fathers, how they don't care if they're guilty, and how, you know, the father is in general a negative presence in their child's life.
So what was the driver for that? Why would they do such a thing?
So some of it is ideology. There's a big ideology that, you know, kids don't need, you know, is it identity or is it just as long as they have one good caregiver, what's the best for a child? If there's a case of any accusation of abuse, do you investigate the accusation or you say, well, if there's an accusation, that's enough because nobody makes false accusations. But the
right.
big root of this is money. Because when you enter any divorce proceeding or custody battle, right, first of all, you're paying the lawyers, and it's where people realize there's a lot of money to be made. But also all the psychologists, social workers, court-appointed officials, they also have to get paid. And these therapies can cost thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars, as well as evaluation. So the longer the conflict is prolonged, the more money can be made. And that's the same in Argentina, the United States, Great Britain. This is definitely a worldwide problem. And when the film came out in Argentina, it was one of the first films in about 30 years that was censored.
Yeah, it was banned in Argentina, right?
It was banned in Argentina for, I think, about 8 months and went all the way to the Supreme Court because the people who we had interviewed, who, of course, signed releases, and we were very clear we were making a documentary, they said they didn't like how the film portrayed them because the people who work in the family court system, they're so, I would say, drunk on power, that the idea that anyone would dare criticize them or they're not the heroes was shocking to them. And most people are horrified when you hear, you know, the worst place for a child is their own home because of the presence of the father. Most people are horrified. Or they're horrified, I don't care if he's guilty. I just work with the child and buy them time so they eventually learn to reject their own father. People find that horrible. They think that they're the heroes in the story protecting children. And that's where a lot of this conflict comes into play. And I returned to the U.S. in 2015 and immediately began work on the follow-up film, Erasing Family. And this film is very different, one in that it follows stories from the United States, Canada, Sweden, other parts of the world. So it's a very international film.
I want to can I ask
ahead.
You to hold 1 second?
Sure.
I want to really get into Erasing Family, but... Before we do, I still have a couple of questions on Erasing Dad because I think there were a couple very impressive points to me. One of the things that made the film so popular is it went underground, right?
Yeah.
It went underground, and then that sort of forced the government to look at it. And as a result, did the government not change child custody laws in Argentina as a result?
Yes. Yeah, so what's very interesting is that Argentina allowed for joint custody, but only in cases of same-sex marriage. But if there's in a case of heterosexual marriage, custody automatically went to the mother. But you can't gender discriminate in same-sex marriages, they had the option of joint custody. So it wasn't even an option in Argentina. You could not have a legal case of joint custody until the film came out. And then they enacted a joint custody legislation, in part because of public outcry. There's still a lot to be done. It doesn't mean it's becoming more popular. But also the biggest thing is that now people have a new vocabulary to talk about this. They're not ashamed. And the Facebook page in Argentina, last time I checked, has about 40,000 very active followers. And by that, I mean if we post something, you know, I'll get 100 comments, 1,000 shares. Because people find that, you know, what we really do, and I think my role as a filmmaker is and then a communicator, is giving people the vocabulary to talk about this in a way that's clear, concise, that moves people, that's not too technical, that's not information overload. Because the people who are going through this, the parents who can't see their kids, they're traumatized. So when they talk, it comes off sounding like they're crazy.
Right.
So one thing that we can do is give them the tools on how to convey their story in an effective, simple way that people can understand. Because, you know, it's not only that you can't see your kid, but that nobody kind of believes you. No one thinks it's a problem. Or it sounds like a huge conspiracy theory. Because people always say, well, you just go to the courthouse and say, I want to see my kid.
Sure.
And what people don't realize is that in many instances, going to the courthouse can cost you know, if you use a lawyer, thousands of dollars. And if you don't use a lawyer, you might be discriminated against by the judge because you are representing yourself. Or you don't know how to navigate the system, which is very complicated.
Oh, yeah. And I think I read you said somewhere that there are more resources spent on child support than there are child custody.
Yes, that's something that I'm focusing on the documentary on the U.S., which at first I was like, I don't want to talk about child support because, you know, kids need support from both of their parents. They need money. And I feel like it can often be like a red herring. But when I interviewed children and their parents about why they got a raise, often child support was used as almost like blackmail. In a lot of cases, it was they couldn't pay the child support, so the judge would either give the kids up for adoption or they felt coerced to sign away their parental rights because it was a debt they knew they would never be able to get out of. And child support is one of the few debts, I think the only debt in the United States that you can go to jail for.
Oh, is that right?
Right. So one in eight men in jail in South Carolina are there for non-payment of child support. And most of them are dirt poor. They make less than $10,000 a year. And because when we think of, like, you know, a deadbeat dad, we think of some guy who's really rich, who's spending all his money on a mistress or new girlfriend, driving around a Maserati. I mean, that's and most people are people who are working, you know, who are making less than average income, and if one third of their income has to go to child support, it sounds like a great idea, but then how do they pay their bills if they have multiple kids? I really feel that, you know, encouraging joint custody and shared parenting can encourage this because then there should be less child support moving and both parents just equally sharing in the cost of raising a child. So I didn't think that the film would touch upon this, but then also just seeing how you'll have, you know, huge offices of people who are enforcing child support, the money we spend to jail somebody for 6 months for non-payment of child support, you know, on average is about $40,000. All that money could be going to children.
Right.
Or services.
Yes.
But instead, it's spent on putting people in jail, police-style sweeps. And, and most people, you know, what I've heard from a lot of people is that the people who won't pay because they don't want to, very quickly when the enforcement mechanisms begin to step in, begin to pay. It's the people who can't pay who find themselves in this, you know, predicament of not knowing what to do because often their driver's licenses will get suspended.
So they can't drive
to work.
Yes.
You know, so it's this. It's
craziness. It's a crazy, crazy downward spiral. You know what I want to do before we get into, because I'm ready to start talking about erasing family, but I just want to make one thing clear from the start, Ginger, that in case our listeners are not exactly clear, we are not talking about limiting custody because of child abuse or drug alcohol or drug and alcohol or legitimate cause. This is really more like an act of revenge by one parent to another. It's sort of hateful. Am I using my words too strong?
Exactly. I mean, I always like to put the emphasis on the system because, you know, people can be crazy or hateful or vengeful for many different reasons. The problem is that when the system encourages this behavior or it lets people get away with it, so it emboldens them to do this more often, that to me is the real problem. Because this problem would go away if the first time one parent interferes with custody and a custody exchange, right? Doesn't let the kid go with the other parent. If there was an enforcement mechanism, most of these problems would go away quite quickly.
Well, nothing
happens. So they say, last time I didn't let the kid go for a day. Next time I won't let the kid go at all to the custody exchange, right?
Well, if there's 22 million parents, you know, my math quickly tells me that's 11 million families minimum.
It's 22 million because those are the parents who are being erased.
So it's 22 million families. What's the pushback from the courts? Why do the courts not see this as an important issue?
I think there's a lot of reasons. One is just, well, I'll give you an example. I recently filmed in a court system. I don't want to say where. I'll reveal it in the film. It's in the United States. That really pushes parents towards mediation and offers parents a wide variety of services on-house. They're all very, very low cost, and if you're low income, they're free. So you can get mediation, custody evaluation, mental health care services, parenting classes, all in one place, and they're all super affordable or free. And I was at a conference where they were talking about this, and everybody in the room, were all people who worked in other systems, were in shock that they were able to do this. And it seems so kind of, you know, logical. And when I was filming with the crew, they thought we were just filming a normal system. When I explained this is the only place in the U.S. that offers these services, they're like, but it seems so logical that you would give, you know, mediation services and help people. It's like, and so one issue is just, you know, they say, oh, you need help, get a lawyer. Oh, you need help, hire an custody evaluator, which is $5,000. Oh, you need help, hire a psychologist. Oh, you know, so people have to hire these services, right? So that's part of it. A lot of places are very backlogged. Another problem is that, you know, there's no consensus on what to do. I was at the same conference. I asked, you know, judges and lawyers, you know, what do you do when one parent doesn't let the other parents see the kid? And the answers I got were completely different. No one is in agreement. And I feel like people are talking about it more, but people aren't really willing to look hard at how the system works and really reimagining how child custody is decided from the ground up. So they're willing to, you know, the classic one is instead of changing the laws, they'll say instead of custodial parent, we'll say primary parent. Instead of visitation, parenting time. Sounds great. It's still the same thing. Or they'll say we encourage shared parenting, but in a lot of states, if you have less than 50% of the time, you have to pay child support. So it just encourages parents to try to claim that they're the better parent so they can get the child support.
Boy, so it does get really complex. One of the things I read, I'm going to ask one question right before we go to break, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about your new film, Erasing Family. Mm-hmm. But before we do that, I read that as in Argentina, that money plays no small role in this, and that there is that I think I read that there is legislation in, did I read 22 states that is being held up because of lobbyists and attorneys that this is too lucrative. They don't want these laws to be made this way because it's so lucrative in the legal profession. Did I read that correctly?
Yes. So a lot of family law bar associations will actively lobby against shared parenting laws. And what they claim is that each case needs to be looked at individually and really, you know, come up with the best solution for that family. But for me, that's a code word for taking it to trial, having a judge decide, where you need lawyers who are, you know, duking it out.
Yes.
And these are not mediated settlements. These are court battles, which are expensive and then leave everybody, you know, with a really bitter feeling in their mouth. So
I just have so many friends. I mean, when I say so many friends, you know, like half dozen friends that are going through this, and the costs are absolutely atrocious. The length of time is inconceivable. I mean, you're talking years. You're not talking days and months. You're talking years of lost time with children. And the children don't get to see their parents. The children are confused about their parents. The parents are just brokenhearted, and one parent gets to win. It's a terrible situation. Let's, Ginger, let's take a break. And then when we come back, I want to hear all about your new film.
Okay, sounds good.
Hi, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie. Today is a critical show, and we're talking with Ginger Gentile, and who is a film producer, and we're talking about her new documentary that's coming out on Erasing Family, where there's a custody dispute, and it ends up that one parent ends up with total custody of the children, either by law or just by happenstance, and another person is totally erased, and the children don't have access to both parents. And Ginger is a director, producer, writer, and she is doing this new film titled Erasing Family. And I want to hear from Ginger, what is Erasing Family about? Tell me about this film.
So Erasing Family centers on the stories of young people in Canada and the United States who, at around the age of 18 or in their early 20s, find out that a parent who they always thought had abandoned them or didn't love them or was unfit actually did love them, wanted to be in their lives, was a fit and good parent, and was just erased by the court system. And we follow them as they reconnect and reunite with that parent, and all of the emotional fallout that happens when they have to confront what happened in their past. Often there's backlash from their other family, the part of the family that did the erasing. So these kids end up feeling that, like, they never have both parents in their lives. And those personal journeys of redemption and hope are also contrasted with an expose of why the family court system allows this to happen, how they make money off of prolonging custody disputes, and how our laws and ideologies that govern child custody after divorce or separation is very outdated in many cases. So it's really a film that I'm making. While it's a film for everybody, because we all have, you know, families and divorces and so many, it's really a film that I'm focusing on the young adult children of divorce. And there's surprisingly very little or next to nothing out there for them. I was just on Amazon trying to find books for adult children of divorce, and I wasn't able to find anything.
You know, I'm looking at the some information that you sent me, and I won't say names, but three quotes from a 23-year-old, a 12-year-old, and a 13-year-old. And the 23-year-old says, I'd say to my sister, our dad is not a monster. He is nothing like what we were told he was. So she was lied to all this time. The 12-year-old mm-hmm. says, my dream is to live a week with my mom, a week with my dad, and have my brother with me, because siblings are alienated from one another. And then the 13-year-old said, and this just broke my heart, some families have photos and memories. I have court documents.
I forgot we have a case from Argentina, and that's very heartbroken because she's at 13. She's desperately trying to see her two half-siblings, and she has gone to court to request visits, which there's no law guaranteeing sibling visits in Argentina, or I think in most countries in the world.
Right.
And what's so sad is that she has become so depressed from not seeing her siblings, she's begun to cut herself, and then the court says, well, she's so emotionally unstable, she shouldn't see her siblings.
Right, right.
But she's emotionally unstable, and the actual psychiatrist report, which I had her read aloud to me, says, due to the inaccess of seeing her siblings and all of the stress, she's developing infantile depression.
So
the system's basically torturing her.
Yeah, it's a regressive spiral. That's terrible. So your film, Erasing Family, it focuses on the children of these families.
It does.
Is that correct?
It focuses on the children.
And it focuses mm-hmm. on their stories.
Exactly. So each story is different, but I follow them as they try to work out what happened to them. They try to understand what happened to them. So often it's asking really tough questions of their family members. In some cases, they actually go through the court documents themselves. And they try to piece together what happened to them. And in all the stories, even though each story, of course, is very unique, there's amazing similarities in all of them. And just talking to the kids, like one thing that I found is a lot of the kids, I'll ask them questions about their childhood, and they'll say point blank, I have no memories of my childhood. I just try to block it all out.
And at what age are they telling you that? Are they telling you that as adults? Or?
They're telling me that as like around the age of like, you know, 18, 19.
No kidding, that young.
But I'll ask them, you know, like, because, you know, in one interview with a girl who's reunited with her mother, the mother would say stuff, and I'd ask the girl, can you confirm what your mother's saying is true? And she'd say, I have no memory of my childhood, but it seems plausible.
No
way. Like, and she was like, I just decided not to form memories.
So what is it? Can you give me? Yeah, that's horrible. Can you give me briefly? I know this is maybe an impossible question to answer, but can you give me sort of a storyline of what somebody's story, what one of these children's stories might look like? So
sure.
Me and my audience can get a feel for it.
So one of the main stories is Ashlyn. Ashlyn's a beautiful, bright 23-year-old girl who lives in Northern California. And when she was very young, she was separated from her father.
What would very young be, like 4 or 5?
10. She never met him.
Oh, okay.
So her father was married to her mother, but the mother left when she was pregnant. And the father said he saw her when she was 10 months old in a courtroom. And then at around when she was about 10, her mother calls her dad up and says, the girls want to see you. Do you want to see them? And he goes, of course. And they begin to see each other. Everything seems, you know, pretty happy. And then at one moment, the mother says to the dad, you know, you're in such a debt from child support, and I know you'll never be able to pay all the money you owe. But I have a plan. If you let the stepdad adopt the girl, you won't have to pay any child support. And it's just a piece of paper. You'll always be the girl's father. And, you know, he doesn't like the idea, but he also doesn't know where the girls live because the mother always brings them to him. So
right.
He feels like he doesn't have a lot of choice, signs some papers, immediately regrets it. Girls get adopted by the stepdad, and Ashlyn talks about, you know, feeling like she had to lie to the judge that she didn't want to be adopted. But her mother was like, you have to say you want to be adopted. And when Ashlyn is about 14 years old, she finds her dad on social media. They begin to Skype. And one day when they're Skyping, the stepdad pulls out the internet connection and says, if you want to live in this house, you can't talk to him. So she becomes homeless for a while, living on the street.
Oh, so she left. She didn't listen. She left. She said she wanted. Oh,
but, of course,
goodness.
Her father can't look for her because she's been adopted, so that would be kidnapping of a minor.
Oh, my goodness.
So she's homeless for a while, eventually decides that, you know, she can't be homeless. So she agrees to not talk to her dad, but on her 18th birthday, she finds her father, and then a few years later, she's living with him again. But as the result of this action is that while her father and her have a great relationship, I mean, some of the scars, I mean, she talks about this in the film, she started having sex at the age of 12. She cut herself. She's a very bright girl who never graduated high school. And, you know, she said, you know, suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder, has walking nightmares during the day. From all the trauma that was caused to her. And also her family, the mother's side of the family, won't talk to her now that she's with her dad. And so she says, you know, I have my dad, but I don't have my mom. And I mean, obviously she did not have a good relationship with her mom. Her mother was quite abusive, but she felt like the main cause of the conflict was the fight over her, which made any issue her mom had much worse. So, I feel like a lot of the kids, what surprised me too, is how even when it was clear that one parent was the better parent from what they told me, how they said, if there was shared custody and the courts just made my parents share, they would have fought and everything would have been better. That really surprised me, talking to so many kids, is how much they really wanted things to be have been split more equally.
I think I read somewhere. Yeah. Didn't I read somewhere that you wrote that 73%, was it right, of millennials?
Right. That's from a study from Arizona State University. That's a poll. That 73% of millennials support shared parenting. But I have talked to so many kids who have been through high conflict divorces, and what they tell me is that their wish would have been to have a kind of a 50-50 timeshare split imposed by the court, because then their parents wouldn't have fought.
Yeah, which is, you know, who knows how that would have turned out, but at least they would have sibling contact. They would have contact with their parent.
Right.
You know, I know of one family that the two siblings, one sibling had a breakdown with the other sibling. It's sort of different than this, although exactly the same. And the one sibling completely erased the other from her life. And, you know, there's like eight children involved that don't get to see each other. They don't know their cousins.
Wow.
They've never visited cousins. They have no idea what they look like because no photographs are sent, no communication. And if the one sibling thinks the other is going to be at an event like a funeral, like a major event like a funeral, she won't attend. She just won't go there because my sister's going to be there. And it was all because of some begrudgement that if I give the details, it'll give the story away. So I don't want to do that.
But
it was truly not a major event. You know, it wasn't wasn't something. And it's just horrible. And I've seen when we interviewed a mom last week, and she talked about, you know, that there's erasing. I'm an erased dad. I'm an erased mom. I'm an erased cousin. I'm an erased brother. I'm an erased sister. And it is just it's horrifying. And especially then, as you said, the children seem to take responsibility for that.
They do. I mean, children always, you know, blame themselves for this. But I think the worst thing about what happens to these kids is they lose a sense of identity. They're taught by what they see that the correct way to deal with conflict or people you don't get along with is to get rid of them, to replace them. So I always say to kids, you can love or hate your family, but don't erase them. Because we might not have great relationships with family members, and people might have problems. I'm not denying that. But it's one thing to say I have a bad relationship with my mother. It's another to say she's not my mother, she's my egg donor. Which is what these kids will say. They'll use language like sperm donor, egg donor, birth mother. To people who did not give them up for adoption, who maybe raised them for 15 years. And, you know, I think it causes a huge mental break because you are denying a part of your identity. You're denying who you are with that. And one, if there is problems in a family, most families have problems, of course, only by accepting that you are part of that family and learning from the actions that the other family members are doing and trying not to repeat them and doing the work on that, can you move forward? If not, you're doomed to repeat these cycles. And so many erased families, they know of at least that this problem goes at least one generation back, maybe more. But most of the, you know, the kids I talked to have been erased, you know, this also went on in the previous generation. So when you erase a parent from your child's life, when you erase the other parent, you're dooming your child to almost one of two options, right? Which is one, that when they grow up and have kids, they are erased from their kids' lives, or they're the ones doing the erasing because that's what they were taught.
Yeah, I read the stats that said of the children that go through this, 70% of these children suffer depression, 35% mm-hmm. find themselves with drug and alcohol abuse, an amazing 15% find themselves involved with the same issues as an adult because that's what they know. That's the way they were raised, and that was the way they know how to deal things.
I think from what I'm talking to kids, it's maybe higher than 15%, unfortunately.
No, I said 50.
Oh, 50. Oh, 50. Yeah, that seems accurate.
Yeah.
A lot of kids, too, when I interview them, they say, no way in hell am I having a family. I'm not putting kids through this. Are you nuts? You know, I mean, they just say, like, you know, relationships aren't for me, kids aren't for me, no thank you. You know, because they just say, like, why would I torture somebody?
Right.
You know, that's their response. So I would say that I would be interested in knowing of the 50% who say they aren't repeating these relationships, is that because they just don't ever develop a long-term relationship or have kids?
Right.
You know?
Right.
Because for a lot of kids, that's what they'll say, is they have a hard time developing relationships.
Of course.
And what's interesting to me, and this is why everybody should care, even if, you know, you've never been divorced or you don't have kids and never plan on having kids, is that this is such a common problem. It's something that nobody talks about, and it has such a collateral effect on children who eventually become adults, who eventually have these huge emotional and psychological problems. And also the research is finding that toxic childhood stress causes also physical health problems. You're more likely to develop cancer, diabetes, heart disease, which makes sense. If your body's always, if you are always under stress, you release cortisol, which eats away at your cells, basically, right? If we could solve this problem, and other countries and even places within the United States are trying to do so, if we could enact this on a wide scale, we could save so many kids from needless, pointless suffering. Not to mention all the wealth that is wasted on lawyers' fees and court fees. I heard one statistic, I haven't looked this up, I just saw this today, that the U.S. economy, this costs the U.S. economy about 3% of the GDP each year.
Holy cow.
Not on the cost, not just on the cost. People think about, like, oh, you pay, you know, $50,000 to a lawyer.
Right.
But if you become depressed and can't work, you know, if you,
then
just, you know, if you have to go to, if you're in jail for not paying child support, so you can't work. So all that cost as well, but not just the cost, but, you know, the wasted time, income, and stress that prevents you from earning. This is a huge problem. And it's something that, you know, what's so interesting to me, nobody really talks about this, but whenever I mention it, people always know somebody very close to them who has gone through this.
And they think it's rather isolated, don't they? They don't know.
Everyone
that.
Everyone says, I thought I was the only one.
Yeah.
Everybody says that.
Yeah.
I thought I was the only one because nobody talks about it.
Well, Ginger, this is a for me personally, for some reason, this whole subject of erasing family has really struck my heart, and my producer Paul is sitting there shaking his head because he's probably never seen me or rarely seen me this involved in something. And you're very passionate about it. Why don't you tell us what, once the film is released, you have, I'm sure you have objectives. I'm sure you have a vision of what would happen. What are your objectives for this film? What would you like to see happen as a result of this film?
The two big objectives are, the first one is that the young people who see this film, who maybe have a parent who's been erased from their lives, are encouraged to accept the phone call when that parent calls, answer the email when emails, and begin the process that can be very difficult but also very rewarding of reuniting.
Even if they're strongly against it, and maybe because they're strongly against it, this film could encourage. Oh, they're always strongly against it.
I mean, yeah, they're always like, no way in hell, never.
Exactly.
Often kids just will cry hysterically when a parent contacts them and they don't know why, or they'll have a panic attack. And that's one of the issues, because if someone says, every time my dad emails me, I have a panic attack, most people would say, well, block your dad, never talk to him. And they never ask, well, why? What did he do? And often the response is, I don't know, but I just get so upset. And those are the cases because when there's real abuse, people will say, because he did this, this, and that, right? When people say, I don't know, he's just a bad person. He's so bad.
You okay, know? So the one issue is that young people are encouraged to have dialogue. What would be your other objective?
You said
with their parent. Yes.
And that society begins to see that this is a huge public health problem that can be solved. This isn't an inevitable part of divorce. The laws and the system are designed to encourage this to happen. And society doesn't, you know, it's the same with, you know, domestic violence. 30, 40 years ago, it was seen as a problem that shouldn't be made public, right?
Exactly.
And now it's seen as a public health problem that, you know, there's resources for people and that it's not inevitable that, you know, intimate partner violence happens. But we still live in this world where people think this is just an inevitable part of divorce. One parent gets more custody, one kid aligns with the parent. And I want people to see that there is a better way out there and we need to work on this because it affects so many people, especially because not only divorce, but so many people aren't ever being married, but getting married when they have kids. So that's going to be a huge issue I heard coming up in the film, too, is that for the next generation, is how do you arrange a joint parenting plan with two parents who don't know each other?
So where are you in the film process right now? Have you done all the filming, or is there still more filming to do?
So the good news with The Racing Family is that we are officially done with filming. Of course, we have, you know, if something comes up or we find like we're missing something, we will film some more, and that almost always happens with documentaries when you begin to edit. But we've been working on this since 2016. We've shot all over Canada, the United States, Sweden, Argentina, and we've also gotten videos and footage from all over the world. We want to show this is an international problem of parents being erased from their kids' lives.
Oh, okay. So that's actually another objective, that it's an international issue.
Well, I feel like we're, just because that's where I am, we're focusing more on the U.S. and Canada. They'll be very clear that this is not a problem with the U.S. court system and this is not a problem with one judge, right? This is a systematic problem. So, and our goal is to have the film released later this year, have it finished this year. And when it's released, and, you know, obviously we're hoping for a festival premiere so it can get traction and that'll be, you know, on HBO or CNN or Netflix or some platform where it's very easy to watch. We'll also be doing a tour of high schools and universities throughout North America. Or anyone
when will that happen? Will that be 2019?
That'll be more 2019. And I want every person who works in the family court system to watch the film. So that's one of our objectives, to make sure that either in a viewing or via link, they will get a copy to everybody who works in the system. And then another simple goal that I have is that people who are inspired to action, because a lot of people who are suffering from this and want to help, they feel like there's nothing really concrete they can do, or their goals are like, we need to get the president to change this, and that's not how laws work. I want to get people to make presentations to their local schools, to the PTAs, their Kiwanis boards, their churches, their temples.
You know, now, are you going to offer templates and transcripts for them to do
that?
We're
going to offer templates, PowerPoints, and, of course, just watching the film and having a discussion afterwards. But my kind of simple goal that I think would be easy to do is to get each school everywhere before every major school event, you know, like a school graduation or holiday pageant or something, to send home a letter or email saying, we understand a lot of families are separated, and it's very hard for them to be in the same event. But no child should be asked to choose which parent can go to the event,
right,
and we will gladly speak to you separately. Because
right.
For me, in my case, I remember this all started when I was about 13, and I was graduating from 8th grade, and my parents said, we can't be in the same room together. Who do you want to go to your graduation?
No way. At 13 years old, you're forced. They're asking you to make that decision.
You're asking to choose, and you know, if there was some letter or something, because the kids are not going to say, you know, you guys are, you know, emotionally abusing me, please stop. But if there's some sort of letter, you can be like, oh, the principal said not to ask me that, you know.
Right.
Or they just do that. I mean, obviously, and this is important, when people have suffered from mental illness and are doing this because they're mentally ill. That's a separate situation. But if society sends the message this is unacceptable, I think a lot of these cases would decrease, because you're just saying, don't force your kids to choose. Don't use them as a pawn. This really creates harm. And I think that would create far fewer of these cases. And just get people started talking about this, you know, that it's not normal. It's not normal. It's not healthy. And it should not be acceptable to erase a parent from their kids' lives. Just as, you know, right now, you know, if a parent said, you know, yeah, I smoke cigarettes and I always smoke with my kids in the car, most of us would say, hey, that seems like an unhealthy choice for your kids, right?
Right.
But when people say, oh, you know, he did this and he left me, blah, blah, so I'm going to get at him. And a lot of people say, good for you. You know, get him for everything. You know, use the kids. And that's what we need to stop.
So you see the film, like, I know you want to go to festivals and all. Do you see that happening in 2019? Is that when you see all of that sort of coming about, that this film sort of launching?
So that's the fun part. That's the part I can't plan. I want the film to be done in August of this year. But then what festival accepts it? It's kind of out of my hands at that point. I can submit it. So, I mean, obviously, you know, the one that everyone thinks about is Sundance, which would be in January of 2019. But, you know, I'm putting it out there in the universe, but there's no way to plan for that. So
well, it's such a brilliant topic that how long is the film? Just out of curiosity.
I don't know the exact length yet, so it'll probably be around 90 minutes. It'll also be released with two books. Which I'm working on, one for parents and one for adult kids with divorce.
Perfect.
And by adult kids, I mean over the age of 16. And for parents, there'll be kind of the extended interviews of the families and kind of patterns we've seen to help parents know how to, you know, counteract this. And for the adult kids over the age of 16, it'll be more like a workbook, and I might have an app to go along with it to kind of walk them through the reunification process. Assume that they don't want to do it. So it's going to start from that premise that they don't want to reunite, and kind of saying, you know, but most kids, they know that something's kind of off, right? So
right.
Kind of coming at them from that aspect.
Right, that's a great idea. I love that.
And we already have, and the film's not even done, we already have 17,000 members on our Facebook page. People can find us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, at Erasing Family. And we're always posting stories from people, photos, and if people go to our website, erasingfamily.org, they can also leave a video tribute for their kids if they're an erased parent or erased grandparent, sibling.
So you have resources right now for people that they can use right now. Yeah, I'll make sure we'll get together, and I'll make sure I include all of that on the show notes. My one last question is this all paid for?
It is not. We have had a very successful crowdfunding campaign, and we have raised about $120,000 from individual donations. And everyone who donates $50 or more gets a thank you in the credits or a dedication to their children in the film. And we also had a grant from Canada of about $200,000, so that's very exciting. But to have such a robust impact campaign and to finish the film, and make sure that we can get it out there and do a huge tour of schools and really get people talking about this. Because if you just do a movie and just put it out there, nothing really happens.
Right.
We want to get this in the hands of legislators and people within the family courts and really change the public discussion about this.
You have to put legs on it.
If people want to make it a tax-deductible donation, they can do so at erasingfamily.org.
Okay, so they can do for $50 and up, they can go to erasingfamily.org and they can donate, and it's to a nonprofit, 501c3, and so is your crowd rising? Is that done, or are you doing that at all anymore?
We are doing that. I mean, what's so interesting about this topic is that I didn't even do a traditional crowdfunding campaign on my Kickstarter. It's just literally a donate button, and we've had about, I think, 20 people who I have never met donate $1,000 each. the people who I've never met, never talked to, they just see this and they're like, wow, because I think it's really important to not only talk about the problem, but to give people hope and to show people that this is awful, but you can get through this. You can come out whole. You can reunite as a family and learn from this. It's not all doom and gloom, because the criticism I had with a racing dad was the end was so depressing. Because at that time we didn't really see any people who had reunited, so the end is fairly depressing, because it was just like people, you know, crying and no laws being changed. So this film, we're going to end on stories of hope, and I think also just giving people the tool of saying, you know, I'm an erased parent, erased by the court system. It's something that's so simple that everybody gets it. It's not a psychological term.
So how far are you from your financial objectives? Are you close? Are you a long way?
I would say that we're close. We probably have about $150,000 more to raise.
Between now and August.
Yeah, and then with the impact campaign, it's kind of the more the better. So I know documentary films that have had $1 million fund for their impact campaign, and basically, you know, it means you can offer the movie for free. You can offer to do the tour at low cost for places that maybe don't have money. It also means, I'm not sure if you want to go this route, but I remember I attended a conference with family court judges, and they all showed up because it was a free lunch at the Beverly Wilshire. I'm not saying that we want to do that, but the more you can offer, you know, people, you know, making it very easy for them to see the film and have a discussion afterwards and these materials, I think the more people will do it. Because I've talked to educators who are like, oh, I would attend a course on this if I didn't have to pay for it. So we're very aware of that. And that's why, you know, we're asking for people donations now, so that way all these materials that we're creating will be available for free or very, very low cost.
So you are looking for donations between $50 and $1 million.
Yeah.
So anybody listening, $50, you don't think that $50 is a lot of money. To some people it may be, but you don't think $50 is a lot of money. But, you know, you get 500 people with $50 and all of a sudden, you know, you're just... You're really inching up on your goal. I know.
I don't mind saying
publicly that my family and I are, in fact, going to contribute.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Well, it's just I believe in what you're doing so strongly. Ginger, this is this has been an amazing interview.
Thank you.
My old man said, I can say this to younger people, I'm so proud of you. that you are doing something so worthy and something so worthwhile and something that's going to change and impact families. I just can't be more excited about this and hoping that this can go forward. So to all our listeners, I will include all of the contacts that you can follow Ginger on, and you can follow Erasing Family, and I will include the sources that you can donate, and I encourage you to donate and have your name on the film when it comes out. That will be very cool. We're about to close. Is there any closing words you have, Ginger?
I would say just thank you for having me on, Charlie, and making a racing family has been such a journey for me, and I'm sure it's a journey that will help a lot of people. And I just want to close with, you know, no family is perfect. No family is completely healthy, and that's okay, and I think we need to embrace that. And that when we have a conflict with somebody in our family, we need to talk it out, work through it, and find a way to find common ground and to base our decisions on love and respect. And you can have a problem with somebody, but please, please, if you're listening out there going through a tough divorce or a separation, don't erase the other parent. Really, it's really, because it's half of the kid's DNA is that other parent, and it's so important for them to have a relationship with both their parents. And they will, for themselves, figure out the shortcomings of you and the other parent. You don't need to help them by bad-mouthing the other parent or preventing them from having a relationship.
That's
but
great.
Just, it's so important for the kids to have both parents in their lives.
Thank you for such wisdom, Ginger, and thank you for all your hard work. I want to thank you for spending time with me today. It's been most enjoyable. I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie, and also be sure to check us out on our website at thenextchapter.life. That's LIFE. Until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie, right here in Orange County's only community radio station, OCTalkRadio.net.